This tape belongs to the Custer County Library. It is part of an oral history taping series. The subject matter is Hattie Berry of Westcliff, Colorado.
The purpose of my visit today, as I told you, was to ask you about teaching in a rural school. And with Jim having been a bus driver, I think I want to hear about this too. I may not be so positive when you get done. Tell me first of all, Hattie, when you started teaching.
I started teaching in the fall of 1926.
And was that here, or was that
here at Brush Creek? Mr. Baby, am I talking about?
No, not quite.
It was District 8. Custer County, because there was no consolidation. Children walked 3 or 5 miles to school. Never thought anything about it. And that was my first experience.
Uh-huh.
I had 16 children. As I told you before, mostly related people, because the valley was so intermarried.
Sure.
I had children even get to school with frozen feet, and with warm water, and thaw them.
So you really had to be practically an EMT in addition to a teacher, didn't you?
Along with that, you did your janitor work.
Oh, well, I suppose you did, huh?
Every evening, the children loved to clean the blackboards because that was, you know, we thought they were just doing something nice for the teacher. Children used to like to do nice things for the teachers. So they would do that, but we swept every evening. And in the mornings, we had to be there an hour or so before school to get the fires going, to warm the place, take out the ashes. The children would bring in wood, if that was all you burned, or wood and coal. Over at Brush Creek, the well was situated, so it had a lot of seepage from irrigation, and it wasn't very good water. So they carried water quite often. They would come over here to Jim's home and get the water from the spring. Sometimes it went to Gourmet areas, maybe now get the water there. But they carried water. Each of us had to have our own cup.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was
to drink from.
Nothing that was only halfway sanitary way we could get by. Then once a month we mopped those floors and oiled them in order to keep dust down and make it more the air more healthful, I suppose, but that's what we did.
When the schoolhouses were built, Jimmy may want to answer this. Who built them? Was it a community project, or exactly how did they come about?
No, I don't know who built it. I don't know if you built that. But all I can say is that it used to sit right over here across the two creeks, the old Brush Creek School. And they got scared because we had a lot of water at that time. And they got scared and they moved the schoolhouse right over here on the corner.
So they actually moved it quite a bit uphill, didn't they?
Yes, right. Yeah.
It sat between two creeks.
Oh, well, I can see where their concern might be valid.
And our winters, 5 foot snow was nothing.
Sure.
So that was what made so much water.
I see.
And I'm going to say it was, I'm going to say this much, Coonrod Cook donated the land. Now, maybe that'll help you out some.
Okay. Yes, it does. Coonrod's name had to be spelled C-O-N-R-A-D-T, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yes. Now,
and K-O-C-H.
I know about the K-O-C-H. I talked about all these people named Koch to Keith when I first came into the valley, and he said, no, 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 this won't work.
said it wouldn't be Cook either. It was Kuf.
Kuf with an F on the end, huh?
The CH would kind of take a halfway between an F and a K, and that way. But it just came down to Cook.
I see. So they really anglicized that name, didn't they? Can you tell me, Jim, maybe you know this, was Coonrod Cook related to the Carson Coonrods? Or was he perhaps just named after them?
You mean the Coonrods are just to be up in the valley? Mm-hmm. No relation.
I see, just perhaps named for
them. I think Coonrod was a surname quite common in German.
This could be.
I'm going to say this, there was only the four brothers.
That came here.
That came here in the Cook family.
And who were they?
Let's start out to see what Grandpa, my grandpa was the oldest, wasn't he? Coonrod was one. And then there was Fred Cook. There was August Cook and Pete Cook.
So Fred, August, Pete, and Coonrod.
They call Coonrod Cooney. So that if you ever come across somebody that says Cooney, you know.
Okay. Well, it seems like a logical nickname. Now, if you've heard the name Coonrod, the spelling would lead you to anglicize it and say comrade.
Right.
So that,
I guess that makes sense too.
I was not aware that the Berries were partially originally Cooks. I suppose this stands to reason. Among this, I think it's so interesting to find out how people got to be the families that they are today. So I'm going to have to diverge here a minute, Hattie.
Okay.
And find out how the Berries got to be here from the Cooks.
My dad was an Englishman.
Jim.
Am I right?
Your mother. She wants to know about your mother.
Yeah, but I said my dad was an Englishman.
Yeah.
And she married a Knut.
A Knut?
A cook. She married a cook.
Okay. I see.
And Pete. Well, he had married Lena Knut.
Oh.
So you see that? As I told you, they were so intermarried that everybody was related.
Yeah, they really were. Of course, when you stop and think about it, there were relatively few families in this area. Most of them were large families, either when they came or in some years
it's
after.
It's rather hard, I suppose, to think about, but in the early 1900s, along about 1900 until maybe about 1910 or 15 along there someplace, there were eight families that right here on the hill.
So were all those related?
One down here. See what I mean? No, different. A lot of the... Are you sure?
No, I really would like to know this because it's something that that doesn't really come out in all the books that you read.
Well,
and you said it was given by the government to whom?
To Civil War vets, men that had served in the Civil War, either South or North, it didn't matter. But they didn't have the funds in the National Treasury to pay them, so they were given their homesteads. Right up here was Irwin Place, and that he was a war vet. And help me with Fred's Place. Well, anyway, Kaufman was. That was the place you turned down off the highway. Then there was a Kaufman. One had into a man and the other in.
Right.
right over here that was Civil War Band. And Fellows. Now, Ralph Cook, do you know him?
Yes, I do.
He is a descendant from the Fellows.
The Fellows.
Oh, I see.
As if I wasn't confused before.
So you see, at one time, this was quite heavily populated. But then when mining opened up more toward the western part of the state, and they weren't really making money on these smaller ranches.
How large were the homesteads that they were given? Were they 160?
Right.
There were some. There were some that said 360. I think 340. 340. There were some 340.
Gager was the word name I was trying to think.
Well, I was thinking,
that was another.
I was thinking about the place that I had at Grandma's up there. I know that was a 340.
Yes.
Now, was this lesser quality land than maybe this land down in the bottoms was?
No,
I know Fred Baldick was telling me the other day about some of the homestead claims that people had approved of on hand. He divided it into just, for example, the A, B, and C quality. He said the B and C quality of land were given in larger parcels because you couldn't do as much with them. So, and I had not been aware of this at all. There's a lot about the Homestead Act they don't teach you when you study it.
Well, there's a lot about the Homestead Act that's forgotten.
There really is. I don't know why it was never written more clearly and kept alive, but it hasn't been.
Jim, what did you do with that box that had that deed in it with Benjamin Harris's signature on it? Would you want to see it?
I would love to see it.
Yeah, no. I just thought, you know, it was Civil War land.
Mm-hmm. Now, was that only in the north end of the valley? It seems like the south end of the valley was
settled. Was settled by the colony, mm-hmm. and so I rather doubt that there was anything up there, but what was colonized. I can't think of the leader's name.
Wolfstein.
That's right. Well, yeah, I have an idea that their acreages were bought somehow or other through that colony. But it didn't remain a colony too long. You knew
no,
that.
No, only a couple of years. Now, I've been told that they were given the homestead land under the Homestead Act, but had to... Oh, what was the requirement? That you stay 3 years, build an improvement of X dimensions, I think.
Well, and I you think had any to grow homestead some kind of was that crop. Way. Even though, I would say maybe as late as 1923, Jim's brother took up a homestead here in the foothills. They wanted it for pasture. Well, he was required to have a home up there and live there at least 3 months out of the year and have improved so many acreage, you know, into plowing and seeding. But later they took it up under timber and stone, and that type of homesteading didn't require any improvement. And I think a lot of these right close into the foot of the range were timber and stone after that went into effect.
Well, that's okay. I need to ask Patty some questions while you're looking anyway, Jim.
Oh, okay.
I want to learn on tape anyway. I hope to get down to talk some more with her and also do an interview with Bill Vickerman. You know, he's down for full time now. He hasn't been for over a year.
I didn't know that either.
He developed really, really bad heart complications.
I knew that he had, and I wondered about it, but I don't. When you see George, he's got his nose up here so far that you don't know whether you better speak or not.
Oh,
well, I don't know.
it for sale now. Which probably, if shall we just start over and we'll be able to answer some of the questions that I asked.
That's fine, if you wish to. Not, but you'll have to ask questions so
I
know
I
what to tell you.
I will. Okay. Let's just start at the beginning. Where are you from? Because you're not from the valley, right?
No, I was born in Meredith, out of Springs. I went to grade school and high school. And then I took my teacher's training at Colorado Teachers College, which is now the Northern University. Colorado University. Really a great one.
Yeah.
And then my mother had moved to Salida. My father had passed away. So mother had moved to Salida to be with an older daughter. And I was going to go back and finish that year her degree. But because of my father's death, we were a little bit short of cash, and so I got the chance to teach brush cutting. And that was in 27.
How were you made aware of the old? Did they list them?
No, my sister and brother-in-law in Salida were in the insurance business, and they covered this county. And Ray Adams, who was on the school board here, told them that there was an opening. Not that he knew I wanted a school, but it was just in the general conversation. So they asked him about it, and the next day we came over, and I signed a contract. And the funny little things they used to put in the contract, now you must not plan to get married.
Was that for an indefinite time, or for 1 year?
Or that while you had that contract. Well, you see, they didn't approve of married teachers and married women teachers at that time. And,
Well, now I have to stop and ask you, why did they not approve of married women teachers?
For fear of pregnancy.
That terrible affliction, I think.
Well, it would, unless there would be more teachers than what were in the field at that time.
Well, it would be very hard to replace.
That's right. And I have known later on when we did have married teachers and they would become pregnant, they just teach up almost to the last minute. So that
because
it wasn't
there was no
good
such
for
thing
them.
As a pregnancy
no. No. No, we had no retirement plan when I first started teaching. I first was notified and knew about PERA for teachers when, I guess it was in 41.
And you'd been teaching at that time for how long?
From 27 to 41, let's see.
It would have been 14 years. So you had a retirement plan when you started, you would have been well on your way to.
Well, not the way it turned out. They finally made the ruling that they would take your 5 highest paid years and your retirement was based on the last 5 years that I taught in the consolidation because that was the highest pay. Teachers' wages were just beginning to go up then. I started teaching at $75 a month. And it went farther. Than when I was getting $300 or $400 a month.
How exciting that
must have been. Well, don't you know, our lifestyle was different.
Oh, yes.
You didn't go to all
sure.
these places. You didn't have to have something new to wear every weekend. And I remember very distinctly one place I ordered. This was, however, during the Depression, that the lady said, well, if you could pay us $3 a month so we could have steak once a month.
Oh, dear.
you can't believe how the lifestyle has changed, and especially for teachers, well, I think for everybody, since the end of World War II.
I could not imagine before. I'm slowly learning with this project, but it's changed terribly.
Well, the electronics have done a lot of it.
Well, indeed they have.
And then, too, I think people went through the hardship of the Depression, and then World War II, and then they got a little bit, and they thought, well, we're just going to do what we can, so if we have to go down in the dumps again, we have memories.
Yes.
And I do hope that we come out of this hard time with people feeling that they can go ahead and have a good time.
If we don't, part of the hard time will not have fulfilled its purpose.
That's right. Yes, I think there's a reason for it, but I think the Depression there, 29 and through the early 30s, just taught people, well, when you have it, do something.
Mm-hmm.
Don't just sit. Now, I do know people that lived here in this valley, had children in school, maybe they'd go to Canyon if they had to be in the hospital. But I have known some of them to be 40, 50 years of age and have to be as far as Pueblo. So that is too narrow a life. I can see it now. When I first started teaching, I thought, well, gee, the peace and the quiet, everything going by the way I plan a month, that month went. Can you think of that today?
No. I can't even get through one day if I plan it.
We don't either.
I was going to ask you, possibly as an outsider and also as an unmarried outsider, you could view the Depression results here in the Valley with a little bit different viewpoint than the people who were involved with ranching and with the truck farming that was here at that time. How do you remember the Depression affecting people here?
Well, you know, I don't think the rural places were hit as hard as the cities, the more populated. They could go out and put in a garden. Now, most of the people lived on pork. Very few of them butchered beef. They would have fat hogs, you know, and they cured their own meat. So, they had been doing that all this time. If they managed to get money, it wasn't banked, it was buried, or it was hidden someplace in the house or something like that. They didn't trust banks. So they were...
Was this even before the Depression?
Oh, yes. When I first came up here, George Beardsley, of course his father before him, but George was at the head of the bank up here then. And he told me one time during the Depression, he said, if someone would make a run on my bank, Hattie, I could go out here, and I won't name the rancher because he might all still be doing it. He's a very old man now. He said, I could go out here into the southern part of the valley, and this friend of mine could go into his corn crib and get me all the gold I'd need.
Oh my.
Now that was a banker telling me that. We were talking about how would we ever get out of this Depression, see? How would people ever have money? So really, I don't think this valley was too hard hit.
I had never heard that they were that well off.
Well, not everybody.
Sure they were.
But still, you see, even the smallest and the poorest rancher had a pig, a milk cow, and a garden.
Yeah.
So they didn't go hungry. They didn't have to have soup lines and bread lines or whatever you might call them. They were still eating, perhaps maybe not the finest of fare, but good food. So I I do know, of course, now the schools wouldn't have been open because taxes weren't being paid. But most of the teachers who taught here were local people, and they took the school for the term for whatever the district had. I was up at the Willows at the time, and I taught 3 months with pay and finished out the 8 months term because the children had to go on. And I wasn't the only one. Every teacher could see that this was a problem we all had to work on.
Well, and it was left up to you as teachers to get the kids through that time, to get them on with their education.
That's right. Yes, the teachers did it. Now, we had a very good county superintendent.
Who was the superintendent?
Lucy Veman. And if you could look up the records, I think you'd see that she was there. Oh, I couldn't begin to tell you her years. But she was really good. Even when she became quite elderly, she had a very good mind. And I do really believe that if it had not been for her, they would never have had the high school service they did.
I was familiar with Georgiana Kettle's term.
She
was followed by Ruth Lang.
Oh.
But and was Lucy Beeman before Georgiana Kettle?
Well, yes.
Obviously. But did Miss Kettle take over Mrs. Beeman's right after Mrs. Beeman, or was there someone else in there?
Yes. Georgiana took over from Mrs. Beeman. And then when her personality was very strong and very strict, and she could see possibilities in everything. And time is your element in a rural school, or was. I guess it still is if we had them.
I think so.
We were spread too thin. Anyway, but then she would go into the schools demanding that this be done and that be done and something else be done, which really we would have had the children there from midnight to midnight. So she met with displeasure, and then I think Ruth Lang took over.
I think she did.
She was elected.
She tells me that Miss Kettle had chosen not to run for another term.
For the simple reason that defeat was written all over the county.
Well, Mrs. Lane didn't really tell me this, but it was quite evident in our conversation. Mm-hmm. She was nice about Miss Kettle.
Miss Kettle was a nice person. Mm-hmm. It was just that, as I say, she was so domineering, and her own life was run that way.
I have understood this.
She never had a hair out of place. You know, you've seen that type of person.
Yes.
Now, as far as being friendly, surely she was nice to the teachers and all this and that, but she was pushing to the extent that not only the teachers felt it, but the children and the parents. But fortunately, she got over it to El Paso County, and they had more money. They could run in a few substitutes. By that time, we were beginning to use parent aid, and you see, it didn't bother her there, and there she was until she was ready for retirement. So it all worked out fine.
Oh, yes, and she was much better off in that larger area.
I think she was quite... She was quite capable, and when she got over there, I think her program was going over better, and consequently, she was very happy with it. And our Republican county chairman, I think they called, June Cameron, helped her get there.
That was Susan's husband?
Yes. He was county chairman for quite a long time. And he also was a very capable fellow.
I heard nothing.
We have had some wonderful citizens in this valley. We still have.
Oh, yes.
But we were talking about the past, so that's why I said had. But, you know, it all worked out. Then after Ruth Lang resigned, it seems to me, and Miss Kettle took over.
Is this
Miss Francis. And she's very good with the schools. But I remember Mrs. Beeman in particular, because she was there for so long, and she knew everybody, even the first graders, by their first name, because she had been going into those schools for so many years.
Sure, flattering to the children, too.
Oh, well, she was one of them, even though she were maybe 70 years old than some of them. But she was still one of them. But she really did do a lot for education. You know. But I think all of our county superintendents did. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, with consolidation, we didn't need a county superintendent. It was just a figurehead.
Yeah. Well, and still remains so to a great extent, I think.
Wherever they have them.
Yeah. Well, now we do have a superintendent of schools. It's not the same kind of community job that it was years ago before things were consolidated.
No.
I was going to ask you just your own opinion. There's a movement in some areas, not so widely in Colorado as in some of the even more populous states, to kind of retreat from consolidating the schools, and especially for the younger children to go back to the one-room school. What do you think of that?
I think it'd be a mistake.
Do you?
Why? For the simple reason that even if you would just have, say you'd have the first three or first four grades, the curriculum is much richer, much wider than it was when I taught rural. We were very well satisfied if the child in science got a little nature study. You couldn't get by in that with that in this day and age.
No, you can't.
They have to know something about mechanics. They have to know electricity. They have to know radio, television. I don't mean that it's going to be their life work. But how are they going to choose if they don't have the basics as they go along? And some of that basic has to start in your primary grade. I am 100% for consolidation. Do this, but I do. I think that one complaint came from a chronic complainer.
The complaints I've heard have been from that sort of person. I know one lady whose oldest is in second grade, and she has one in second grade and one in kindergarten. And she said even before school started, they're going to be really tired for the first 2 weeks, but they'll manage, and so will I.
That's right. Well, I rode the bus. Jim drove the bus, and I rode the bus. And many and many a time, a first grade child would start to fall asleep on the bus on the way home. And I would just move over and put the child on my lap and let him sleep.
Sure.
That way he had no chance to fall off the seat and hurt himself or herself, whichever. And I can remember Jim Lane, who is now foreman of Trail Sand, rode the bus. And Jim would come back and pick him up just as though he were a wee, not walking yet, and just hand him out the door to his mother. He never awakened.
Uh-huh.
But that didn't go on every day.
Sure.
It would just be, perhaps maybe the family would be up a little bit later, or they would be someplace that he didn't get his nights. Nice rest. But we have done that, and I'm sure older children on the bus help little ones.
Oh, I'm sure they did.
Oh. But what is a wee bit of tiredness or somebody falling asleep on the bus, is that a greater harm than losing out on the enrichment that this program can give them? Now, I'll take the enrichment. If I had even a preschool whether it was even younger in kindergarten, and they opened it up. If I had one of my own, that child would go to consolidation, because I'm all for it. I went through these rural schools and saw these children. Really, now, where I went to school in Idaho Springs, at that time, Idaho Springs was not a suburb of Denver. It was a dying mining town. In fact, my graduation class was 13. So you can judge the other grades, maybe 20 or something like that. But we did have teacher per grade. And no kindergarten, because there wasn't such a thing at that time. But the education that I received right there was broader than what we could give these rural school children.
Didn't it make you ache to know what would be possible from your own experience and then not be able to pass it on?
That's right.
How many, just a rough estimate, I know that it would be impossible for you to make an exact figure for all the years that you taught, but how many children that you taught were able to go on to college?
Well, in the beginning, the first 4 or 5 years that I taught, very few of them went on to high school.
I knew eighth grade was it.
Now, there were instances they could have gone, but it was the parents living in this rural rut. Then after that, it started to pick up, and I would say maybe 1 out of 10 or something like that would go on. And then it gradually grew so that more of them went. Now I think we are overdoing a lot of it. I think a lot of the children that are enrolling in academic work in universities and colleges should maybe be going to vocational or commercial. Because some children are not university material.
This is true. I assume are aware that in the freshman programs in most of the larger universities, they have remedial English and mathematics.
Oh, yes. Something, isn't it? When I went, I suppose at that time, the Colorado Teachers College, if it were, it was accredited, but I doubt that its credits would have carried into any university. You would have had to make up some. But we had to pass the English and the math and the history examination before you could, before they take your tuition. You either passed it or you didn't go in.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
There was no prep. You just simply had to know it. And I remember I missed the English entrance exam by 1/2 of a point.
Oh, dear.
And that was more or less carelessness, but I missed it, let's say. And it could have been I was dumb. So I got to talking about it with my sponsor, and she said, you know, I'm going to talk to Dean Cross. He was not only the dean of the college, he was dean of the English department. And see what he says. Now, she had in mind that I wouldn't take first-year college English because I came so near to passing it. She thought she could get me right into the second, and of course at that time it would have saved some money had I been able to put some other class in there. But Dean Cross called me and he said, I want you to come into my English 1 tomorrow. So I did, and he suggested that I take it. He said, I think you have enough common sense to know that you need a little bit more background than you have.
And I have been very happy to this very day that I did, because when I got out and had eighth grade and even some ninth graders, I could teach them parts of speech, we could parse and decline a verb.
Yes.
How many children can do it today?
Not
they don't
many,
have
but
to.
I know.
No, they don't have to, and so naturally they don't.
Sure.
And sometimes they wouldn't. If they'd see a verb coming down the street, they wouldn't know from a noun or an adverb.
And by the same token, how many teachers without boning up for a few nights at home could teach it?
That's right. But I've been always very happy that he took that interest in me. And I know he wouldn't have if my own sponsor had. See, when we went, when you would sign up at that day in college, you would pick your sponsor. Well, I wanted primary as my major,
uh-huh.
And then I took music in kindergarten as minor. And she was a second grade teacher for the second grade there at the training school.
I see.
But she also sponsored and taught educational classes in the college. The college teachers had to do more than one job at that day and age.
Obviously. Oh, yes.
So I chose her because I thought, well, now second grade would be rather in the middle of every primary, see? So I might get a chance to pick up a slow first grade way of teaching. I mean, to teach the first who were slow. And I might be able to put on a child that could go faster and do it correctly. And so I chose her for that reason. And we just got along splendidly.
Oh, that's marvelous.
So it was wonderful for me.
Oh, yes.
It was a break that very few people get.
How large were your classes
in
college at that time?
Oh, some of them would rank maybe about 50, and the largest one I was ever in was 225. That was a major study class, and Dr. Jean, who was at that time dean of the science, felt that he could take care of most of all of that, you know. So he took other subjects, I think some math, to help a crowded condition, and put a lot of his nature study classes together. But we had to have that one nature study class in order to apply for our degree.
Oh, I see. And then did you have to do practice teaching or student teaching?
Yes, I did, and I was very fortunate there. The teacher that had been out at Kersey, Colorado, took time off, and they came in there for help, and my sponsor got me out there. So I was actually doing my student teaching and making a little wage at the same time.
Oh, exciting.
And exciting. Necessary.
Very.
I don't mean we were poor, but you know, there were four ugly girls in the family.
That makes a lot of difference.
It does make a difference. So,
I've heard people joke that girls are more expensive than boys, and it's no joke, it's true.
Well, I think so too. Their social life starts a little bit earlier, and they're more particular about what we're wearing.
Well, and for so many years, girls just plain wore more clothes than boys did.
Yeah.
I think it makes a difference.
When the lady said to me, my daughter's going off to university. She says she has two trunks full of clothes. She said, I went to Gunnison with two dresses, one pair of shoes, and a coat.
Times have changed.
Yes, in what time she taught, married, and reared this daughter. She was just amazed at what her daughter was accumulating to go to, because she was going to university, which would be a little different lifestyle from a college.
Well, yes, and by the time you get your books
and your favorite hair towel to dry your hair on, and a few casual clothes and your more formal clothes, and your favorite teddy bear. Favorite teddy bears do take up room.
Yes, they do. But we just, I don't think I'll ever forget her remarks about that. I don't think she went with quite that few clothes, but that's what she made. But you know, really, people of my generation have seen such a change. I don't think there could possibly ever be such a big change in so few years.
I would wonder how. Really?
Science has taken over, lifestyle has changed completely. Yes. You couldn't begin to live today like we did then.
People have tried it and have not been successful at all.
That's why I say I would never want the primary to go back to school.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you say that. I had been of the same opinion, but I didn't have quite the years and experience to base it on.
You do.
And somebody who's been there, I think, ought to be well qualified to say.
Well, and then both of them. And I really think any other teacher that came from the rural school into consolidation, even as small a school as we have right there in Washington, you could see the difference. Really and truly, the first year that, see, I kept Brush Creek open 1 year after they consolidated because of the bus situation. They could, at that time, the state law set the number of hours a child would be on the bus, and yes, this was going to be too far by the time they made the whole big run. So I kept this open under consolidation, and then I went in the second year of consolidation to the second grade, and that was in what is now the youth center, or used to be the VFW there. And I tell you, the first month that I was in there, I wondered why I had so much time.
You only had one class.
Yes. And it just seemed to me as though I had just oceans of time. What was I going to do with it? And then it dawned on me, well, let's just use it. So we did, you know, we could put in a lot of things. And having lived so by the clock, I found out I didn't have to. If my reading class ran over a half hour, what difference did it make? We could pick up something. Have to spend much more time about any of those extra classes.
Gosh. When you taught in the one room school here at Brush Creek, how long did you allot for each lesson?
Oh, anywhere. It would depend. A writing lesson was about 10 minutes. Can you imagine learning to make something in a pen? But,
I would imagine that's about all the patience some of your pupils had.
Yes, but 20 minutes was about the length of the class, because by that time somebody else was beginning to wiggle. If they had a book that they would have to take a lesson from, or if you had prepared a lot of seat work or something like that, in 20 minutes' time, that was their span, most of them. And, of course, your little children, when you first started with them, was only about five. But what we used to do, we'd say to if you had a seventh or eighth grader that was interested, and most of them were, they liked to help. Well, now, when you get through, would you, if this child is through with what is supposed to be done, you check it, help them a little bit.
So that kept everybody sitting quiet.
That kept your older students happy. And it kept your younger children from being so bored and so fidgety because their interest span. Really, I think first come into school has an interest span of 5 minutes, that's it.
That they can be deeply involved in something besides television.
So I would agree with you. It grew, of course, as the years went by.
Oh, sure. Sure. Well, and I suppose even for the first graders, as they became more accustomed to the school routine, their attention span would grow.
And then, too, they learned to go get books or extra seat work that you might have sitting on a, in your desk or something, and they would, when they would finish that work, see, they would be independent then. But it would take 2 or 3 months for a child to develop to that. Well, at home, Mama, can I do this? Mama, will you help me? And sure, you know how it is yourself. Mm-hmm. And I don't think children change that much. It's just consolidation that changed schools.
This could well be. While you were telling me about this, I was thinking of the 7th and 8th graders that I know in school and how young all of the adults consider them. You know, we still consider them children.
Oh, yes.
They're just blossoming into their teenage years. And thinking, if that's all the education they could get, would they really be prepared to go on with their lives? And I would have to say no. And I don't know.
Not now.
No, not now. Not as they were years ago when you were teaching several grades at a time.
That's
of course,
right.
I have known and have come to understand more during this project that the kids that were in school even 20 years ago, more like 30 and 40 years ago, had so much more responsibility at home and were expected to accept that responsibility and take on more. So
right.
That maybe they were, if not older, at least more mature by the time they got through the age.
Oh, I'm sure they were. In fact, I think 7th and 8th grade girls are more mature than I do. Because I can get out with those older children and pitch baseballs, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And they would sit back and see the washboard and milk the cows.
Yeah. What was about the average age for a girl to be married in the valley when you started teaching?
I'm just at a loss.
Were most of your girls able to go on to high school?
No. Not the first 2 or 3 years that I taught over here. I can think of very few, that girl or boy, from, let's see, this district here. That was Jim and Dorothy Adams went on. And a few like that. The larger families did not. Well, was it, you know, I had her over here. Either for older brothers or for John. Frank did. He never finished high school. But it wasn't because they couldn't. It was just not the thing. These people that were going on to school, the parents were reckless. You know, they were just being, I don't know, just ultra silly.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. There wasn't the appreciation for higher education then that there
no,
is now.
I didn't have it, and I made my living.
Yeah.
I had one lady say, well, my brother in Ohio didn't finish the 3rd grade. He can't sign the payroll, but he makes a good living. I said, doing what? Working in the coal mines? Now, is that the future you'd want for every child in the United States? But that's what it was here. It was beginning to break in 27, and yet there was very, very little new blood coming in, let's say.
Uh-huh.
Most everyone was still related.
Sure.
Maybe 3rd or 4th cousin or something like that, but...
But still. And most of them were, what, 2nd generation in the valley at that time?
Yes. There were... I did have good fortune to know one of the Mrs. Knuts that came here as a young married woman with the colony. She was grandmother of the bosses, John Knuts' wife, that you know, maybe know her. Esther, is that? No, Esther was the DuWall. But anyway,
I'm not sure.
she was very elderly, but quite quick of mind yet. And I used to go over and visit with her just to hear her talk about the early days here in the valley.
Uh-huh.
There were Indians here.
Yes.
Had you been told that? Did
yes,
you realize
I have,
that?
Yes.
Well, anyway, she said this one came over to her mother's place, or to her place, and her children were home. So she was afraid, see, that he was maybe going to harm them. But he kept pointing and pointing. And finally she decided he was pointing at one of her chickens, and she had three hens. So she picked up the hen to give to him, and he shook his head no. But he kept pointing and, you know. Finally she decided, she went into her storehouse. Most of them had like this rock building down here, mm-hmm. a cool place, because they had no refrigeration.
Sure.
And got an egg, handed to him, he went away happy.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
That is most interesting, to be able to talk to someone like that, that had actually lived pioneer days.
Yes. Oh, my. Did she tell you anything about the trip overland from Chicago? Of course, part of it was on the train. They didn't really go by wagon train very long.
No, they weren't, I think, from St. Louis, or Kansas City.
Yeah,
Kansas City.
Still, that's quite a trip.
I learned most about that from Conrad Cook. He had this place over here that Fred Berry has now.
Uh-huh.
But his folks came in, and his folks' place was over here on the hill where George and Virgie Cook lives. But he used to tell us they were just the four boys, and most of what he told us was how much mischief they got into. But he could tell you quite a little bit. But he said it was just the sway of the wagon, hour in and hour out, and then they had to go slowly or they would have worn out their horses. So the kids would get off and play games along the way and then run and catch up.
For heaven's sake.
But I learned most of that from him.
Yeah.
One time he told me about when they first, they stopped in Canyon City. And the boys went out and they got paper, put around a dog and put kerosene on the paper, set it afire, and in order to smother out the fire, the dog had more sense than the boys, who went under one of the houses. They were built without a foundation, you know. And he said, boy, did we get it? He said, the dog lived, but we didn't think we would. Yeah, I boarded with them the first year I taught him.
I see.
And he used to tell me so much.
Oh, what fun.
But it's like I say, if I were talented enough, I'd write a book. But I'm afraid I'd use names and insult the people that are still living. Everyone that sees me, you know, they'll always say to me, now don't tell my children anything about what I did. Chester Cook is Jim's cousin. He's teaching in Canyon City.
Uh-huh.
Well, he did his student training up here at the high school in math. And the first day he was there, I was sitting in the lunchroom with the children. Uh-huh. I was supervisor that day. And he walked over and he sat down and he said, Patty, you keep your mouth shut. And I knew he was kidding me, you know, but you'd have thought he'd have been a horrible. So I had him the first 6 years of his school.
Oh, gosh.
At Canoe.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you taught in several places in the valley besides Rush Creek, didn't
Mrs. Beeman would come down, she'd say, I suppose that's what made it so interesting that I stayed. There was always a challenge. She'd say to me, I was such a crank. Discipline came. It had to come to you.
Sure.
You couldn't have it.
So she'd say, we're having a participant problem with a certain child. They'll still be in that school next year. There's going to be an opening. Will you apply?
Oh, so you and were kind of a troubleshooter here in the Valley. Huh?
I was the crank. I wouldn't be so sophisticated to say troubleshooter. I was the cranky one. And, you see, I taught Willows, Colfax, Coote, Wetmore.
My goodness. Now, when did you teach at Wetmore?
37 to the 40. That was spring of 41.
I see.
Is Ruth?
Mrs. Menzel was telling about the kids had never tasted an orange or seen a coconut, so she got them all coconuts for Christmas.
And one year, the children asked me if they could please have the decorations off the tree that I had bought, you know, so we'd have a school tree decorated, because I didn't have any at home. So I divided all the decorations we had. There weren't enough, you know, that they'd have a very pretty tree. So Jim and I went and bought Christmas decorations. At that time, you get a whole box full for a quarter, you know. And we had the happiest children around here in this district.
They had
Christmas trees, but never had, I suppose they made me popcorn. I doubt that they could afford cranberries in that day to string, but I suppose they had popcorn, something like that. But one girl told me, she said, we save up all of the little bits of our hair ribbons. And I think I saw them wear hair ribbons twice all the time I taught them.
Oh.
Well, another thing, the Episcopalian church used to send around what they would call your gift basket. And somebody would put something in the basket, whatever money they got, I think, to donate. Well, if there was something in the basket you want, you would take it out, but you must put in equal or more so for what you took out, and then your money donation. And I had one family down here that always came up and asked Mrs. Berry to put in pineapple because their father wouldn't let them have a can of pineapple. So every so often, at a school party, I would have pineapple. Can you think of that being a treat?
No,
you don't. But in that day and age, pineapple was a treat.
It was expensive to buy store-bought canned goods.
And when we, the second year that I had Brush Creek, I talked the school board into financing canned soup, and we would warm them. The children brought their own service and all, you know. And I bought crackers or chips or whatever I thought would have that day. And so we would have the hot bowl of soup every noon. Well, that was just marvelous. And at that time, we didn't have such interesting soup as alphabet, you know. But they would pick out, oh, I've got a piece of chicken today. They analyzed their soup. It was such a treat. Because it was, not that they didn't have soup at home, but they never had it at school. And one of them would say, can we have more than two crackers? Every day that little boy asked me, may I have more than two crackers?
And then he just got two.
He got two. They would measure it out. So I used to say, now you eat what you can. Don't waste. But you eat what you can so that you feel comfortable.
You had one of the very first hot lunch programs, didn't you?
I think perhaps the first one, as far as I know. And I got that idea from having had my teacher's training in Kersey.
Oh.
See, the county did supply them.
I see.
Even in that early day up there in Kersey.
For heaven's sake.
I think their problem was that so many of the settlers in around there at that time were Russian people. And borscht was what they lived on.
Yeah.
Soup, you know. And that was about it. They never had clotheslines. So the Russian women would wash their clothes and they'd just be sparkling clean, but they had to put them over the barbed wire fences or the corral fences or something like that to dry, or hang them over a tree branch. Well, by the time the wind would blow up there in that dusty Weld County, you know, it was all potato country.
Yeah.
Why, that was just their clothes they'd never leave them. In fact, you could tell when they were, a bunch of Russians would come into the theater because you could smell the dust. Now, not that they weren't clean, but their lifestyle was so low down on the ladder. And so I got that idea from up there. When I, the first year I talked about it, one of the board members was rather miserly and said, oh, no, no, what was the matter with me? He thought they hired an insane teacher. Well, I thought so too, but I didn't tell him I agreed with him. So the next year, when early in the year I asked for it, we were having trouble with the well, and he came up to show me how to pump out that well so we would get decent water and the children wouldn't have to carry it. And he pumped and pumped until he was just worn out and perspiration running out of him. He threw bucket and water together, the last pump before he pumped, all the way across the county lane over here.
Oh, dear.
And he turned to the other board member. He said, have this well, get the thrashing man had a pump, see, that he worked with his thrashing machine. He said, you get this well pumped out within this next week. And he started pumping down through the yard, and then he turned around and he yelled back, and get her that soup.
This ends this taping.